This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 178 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, how are we?
Busy, busy, busy. It's been a busy podcast week. We started out with Airplane Geeks at the head of the week, recorded a PAXX podcast with Mary Kirby at the Runway Girl Network. And then I was a guest on episode 39 of the Podcast Engineering Show. And now we have the UAV Digest, so a big week for podcasting for little Max.
And I want to say thank you for covering for me last week. It was a really good interview. It was nice that we had a guest so that you weren't going to go solo. I apologize to our listeners, but we've had some trials and tribulations outside of the podcast world, so I might be popping in and out a lot next couple of weeks, but let's talk about our topics, and I have to give credit where credit is due. These topics were created by my co-host, channeling his inner Vanderhoof.
I tried my best.
The karma is coming back. Biv lost in the Northern Plains. When a drone strike is not a drone strike, a drone port takes shape. More fuel self. Okay, that's not right. I can't even say that. More fuel cell fun. When you need a golf videographer to film a swarm and a wall that's already built and paid for. Our first story comes from Recode.net. GoPro is relaunching its Karma drone after an embarrassing recall. Well, we know that late last year, they were having all sorts of issues with the Karma drone. And GoPro, who's desperately trying to get into the business, wasn't doing really well and was having to recall all of their drones.
That's right. And just recently at the CES show, the GoPro CEO, Nick Woodman, he said that the drones lost power and subsequently fell because of a, quote, basic battery retention issue. Now, it seems that sometimes the battery would pop out in flight. That caused it to detach from its connector, and the resulting loss of power was, well, not particularly useful to keep the Karma up in the air. So that's the reason for the problems and the recall. Now, you know, I think, David, GoPro, of course, what a disastrous start. But I think they handled it pretty well. I mean, they pulled all these things back, even though it was a relatively small percentage of the drones that were experiencing this problem. And they offered the customers who sent their Karmas back a Hero 5 Black. I think that's a pretty classy move.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely trying to appease work in the customer relations issue. Now, for all those people who don't know, CES is the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is the big tech show for the year. And they're going to do the relaunch in February of 2017. We've had a lot of news recently about companies dropping out of the sky as far as going out of business and drone production. So let's hope GoPro can keep up competition, because we don't really want a monotheistic world that's dominated by a certain Chinese three-letter drone corporation.
Yeah, good old competition is, I think, for the benefit of all. So, yeah, we hope GoPro is able to turn this around. They've been having some other financial problems. I think they've had some layoffs and some other issues, but hopefully they'll be able to turn this around. Now, there is a kind of a, I'll call it a pesky class action lawsuit that's concerning the karma and the recall, and this is being led by some shareholder rights attorneys. David, I'm not very current on what they claim the issue is, but I would like to hope that things just kind of get back to where they should be. Shipments begin, and we have happy GoPro karma customers. But we'll see how that lawsuit progresses.
Let's hope the karma stays good and not bad.
There we go.
Well, let's talk about Beyond Visual Line of Sight UAS operations. And this was from UASmagazine.com. We get to talk about a test center in North Dakota, the Northern Plains UAS Test Center. And they've got approval to do Beyond Visual Line of Sight.
Right. This is a big step, I think. The FAA has granted them that. Now, this is for large unmanned aircraft. And the UAS test site is being allowed to use ground-based sense and avoid technologies as it phases in this beyond visual line of sight operation. But we're talking about the big iron here, primarily. What this allows is for large UAS taking off at the Grand Forks Air Force Base will not require a manned chase aircraft. So that allows some, I think some interesting technology to be developed.
It is kind of interesting that one of the things that we've talked about in the past, and I know that when NASA flies beyond visual line of sight, there has to be some, or when the U.S. Air Force is transiting their Reapers or Predators or Global Hawks, quite often they have to have a manned aircraft flying in the airspace with them to assist just in case something goes wrong, because all three of those aircraft are flown beyond visual line of sight. It is kind of funny, Max, that the military is doing this on a regular basis where they're flying drones on the other side of the world. Mm. And we're always talking about like it's not happening, but we're talking about aircraft that are only going to be flown maybe a couple miles from each other. It's an interesting dichotomy now that I think about it, that we're constantly talking about, well, why don't we have beyond visual line of sight? And here we have the U.S. Air Force doing it on a regular basis. And the Customs Service. But Grand Forks was a good old, big old B-52 base. So there's plenty of area there for them to fly in. And Northrop Grumman is going to fly their Global Hawk missions from the base.
Yeah, also General Atomics, which flies, of course, Predators and Reapers from its UAS training academy there. So this Grand Sky UAS Business and Aviation Park that's adjacent to the Air Force Base is kind of a hub for these large drones. So this makes sense as the place to start with beyond visual line of sight.
And here we are, we're talking about Predators and Reapers again. Isn't that what we tried not to talk about when we started the show?
That's right, that's where we started. But now we're back to them in kind of a different sense, so that's great.
Well, let's talk about the failure of Sense and Avoid, or maybe not. This was from USA Today, and I will say that this bounced around our Slack listener team a lot as this story broke and sort of fell through. And the African airline LAM said a Boeing 737-700 on approach about 4,000 feet was struck by a drone, and they published a photograph that looks like something hit this 737, and one of the interesting things that I laughed about was one of the comments was there was no blood and there was no feathers, unlike our little accident that occurred, our drone strike that occurred sometime last year. I don't remember exactly where they reported it as the first drone strike, and until somebody pointed out that they found feathers and blood in the strike. But evidently, we still haven't had our first drone strike, have we, Max?
No. These photographs that you mentioned, David, showed the nose of the 737, the radome, pretty heavily damaged in several locations, some punctures, some creases, some tears, things like that. And there really was a lot of discussion about, is that the result of a of a drone strike or some other foreign object striking the nose of the airplane. And I think there were kind of arguments on all sides. But the Aviation Herald subsequently reported that Mozambique's Civil Aviation Authority, after examination, says that the most likely reason for the failure of the radome was a structural failure and not a foreign object strike. And it's explained that this was actually a used radome that was purchased and installed last June. And in some of the comments about this, there are some opinions that these radomes are laminated. They have several layers. And if you get moisture between the layers, that can cause delamination. And then the air pressure from flying could actually cause the radome to suffer damage and to collapse and in a way that looks kind of similar to the photographs that were published.
And would provide a loud bang like what was reported by the pilots.
Right. There is no internal structure, supporting structure to these radomes because, well, there's a radar dish underneath there. And so it doesn't have supporting structures. It's the structural integrity comes from it being a shell. So, very interesting. A lot of people, I think, are eager to talk about the first or one of the first drone strikes on a civil aircraft. And like you say, David, I guess this one is just not it.
Not yet. Nope, not yet. We'll keep looking. Unfortunately, as I was reported in the press, it's not if it's going to happen, but when. But right now, we're still on the when part. So let's talk about sense and avoid it, drone ports. We're moving from the Arctic north of North Dakota to the warmth of Boulder City, Nevada.
Yeah, we talked about a drone port down there back in episode 165. This was something envisioned near Boulder City, Nevada. But now we see that some more specific plans for a privately operated El Dorado drone port have been announced. Now, there's a company that seems to be at the center of this called Aerodrome. Their website is flyaerodrome.com. And they say that this drone port will be open to the public. And David is going to provide a couple of different kinds of services.
Well, UAS training. So we'll have like your normal flight school at the drone port. FAA repairman and pilot certification and testing. That's kind of interesting. And research and development services. And this is for both commercial and recreational drone operators. So you'll have a place to go fly your drone if you want to pick a Saturday and like our co-host Max Trescott does, go fly his quadcopter. It gives you a place to do it, which is interesting. You're going to go to an airport to fly a drone?
A drone port to fly a drone.
You're going to go to a drone port to fly a drone, but is that going to be legal?
Sure. I would imagine. I would hope so. If not, then the business plan for this is kind of in jeopardy. It's a big site, 50-acre site. And they talk about a 15,000-square-foot terminal building, but also the possibility of expanding quite significantly. They talk about 860,000 square feet of facilities for research and development, facilities for warehousing, hangar space, office space, training space, and also some, quote, build-to-suit opportunities, whatever those may be. It looks like a pretty comprehensive center for UAS. We'll certainly be following this along and see how they progress and if they're successful and if we see other facilities around the country start up with the same kind of a concept. Be interesting to watch.
It has a terminal.
Well, you have to arrive at some place, right?
I was going to say, does that mean that we're going to have a security checkpoint with body scanners?
I hope not.
It is kind of ironic that there's a terminal at a unmanned aircraft facility. But let's move on to This is your favorite subject when it comes to this stuff. And you've already tormented me with it. So let's talk about fuel cells.
Fuel cells. I'm really getting into fuel cells. In fact, I don't know if you've seen this yet, David, but in a few weeks' time, we may have a fuel cell expert come join the show as our guest.
Okay, well, that's good. I will just sit on the side being thoroughly confused. I'm the historian, not the engineer. But let's talk about the French Air Force acquiring a H-2 Quad 1000 drone.
That's right. This is from UAS Vision, another item from them, another story from them. This is produced by a Montreal-based company called Energy OR Technologies. And as you say, David, they produce, among other things, this H-2 Quad 1000 drone. Now, they say that the, quote, fuel cell slash battery hybrid system has been optimized based on extensive UAV flight testing in several different platform configurations. It's been tested in widely varying environmental conditions and can meet the rigorous demands of operational UAVs. Now, it's interesting. It's got a 1 kilogram payload capacity, 2 hour flight time. The power output, net peak power output, is 1500 watts. It's got a flight altitude of 1000 meters. Now, Energy OR has other fuel cell experience. They produce a fuel cell powered APU, an auxiliary power unit, that's designed for field applications. So it's a kind of a small device. One of the applications, supplying power to ground control stations during UAS operations. The French Air Force is interested in these, and this is not strictly a military product. The H-2 Quad 1000, I believe, is available. I think they call it to qualified operators, so we'll see what that means. But, you know, here again, fuel cells.
Paramilitary organizations.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that means. That's kind of a scary thought. But, fuel cells are continuing to move into the unmanned aircraft space as a source of electrical power instead of the batteries that most drones use for power.
And eventually, Max will spin off the
the fuel cell digest.
The fuel cell digest. Yeah. I mean, fuel cells, we've talked about this and we've learned so much about fuel cells, and it's like 3D printing. We never thought we would be talking about 3D printing when it comes to UAVs, also, but we talk about 3D printing all the time. So it's that disruptive technology stuff we keep talking about. You know, we like it all. We just absorb it. Just some of us generate more water than others.
Yeah. The other buzz phrase you hear along these lines, David, is, you know, the democratization of technology, because what this does, what fuel cells, I think, eventually what 3D printing and these things do, is it makes it much easier for, call it the common man, the general public, to utilize these technologies to do interesting, exciting, and valuable things. So it's a really different kind of environment than we had 20, 30, 50 years ago.
And interestingly enough, we were talking about the fact that we were up to 178, and it feels like we just started this show a couple weeks ago. So we talk about so much stuff. This is another one we've talked about, swarm technology. Mm-hmm. And Jane's, one of those favorite things I used to grow up reading, showed an article of the U.S. demos one of the world's largest micro UAV swarms. The DOD had a couple of F-18s and let go a lot of tiny little UAVs.
I think they used the chaff deployment tubes or something like that. Does that make sense?
They were specifically designed tubes, I think, but they were deployed a lot like you would deploy chaff or rocket. They looked a lot more like rocket pods.
Okay.
Normally on an F-18, the chaff and flares are located into the fuselage. but these were pods on the wings like you would see a rocket pod. And instead of the rockets going out the front, these little micro UAVs went flying out the back like you would. You were pollinating the sky with them.
I like that. The visual there is pretty good. So these are called the Perdix, P-E-R-D-I-X. And they're small. The body length around 16.5 centimeters. Wingspan 30 centimeters. They weigh about 290 grams. They have an airspeed of between 40 and 60 knots and a flight time and endurance of something a little more than 20 minutes. These were originally designed at MIT back in 2013. There have been a number of versions, improvements, developments, so they're a little bit different now. We'll put a link in the show notes to a Perdix fact sheet that comes from the DOD. But just to let you know what these are about, that fact sheet says that the Perdix are, now we're talking swarming recall, so keep that in mind. Perdix are not pre-programmed synchronized individuals. They share a distributed brain for decision-making and adapt to each other and the environment, much like swarms in nature. Because every Perdix communicates and collaborates with every other Perdix, the swarm has no leader and can gracefully adapt to changes in drone numbers. This allows this team of small, inexpensive drones to perform missions once done by large, expensive drones. So it's fascinating. And when you watch these things flying, just sort of the collective intelligence of the swarm is, it's almost kind of creepy.
It's kind of like watching a bunch of starlings.
Yes.
As they all move around in formation, you know, and there doesn't seem to be when you see a swarm of starlings or whatever that terminology is, when the birds are all sort of moving around, it's a swarm, and you're right. It is kind of creepy, but the technology is kind of awesome from a military standpoint. Imagine you've got a bunch of enemy aircraft coming from behind you. You launch these swarms, and the swarms attack the aircraft. And, you know, one of those things that would be good to you, how's this for thinking out of the box? You fly the swarms right into the intakes of the enemy aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they get ingested by the engines, take out the engines. Not that I think evil thoughts like this, but I do have a degree in military history. So, I mean, these kind of things were aerial denial. You build a wall, you know. My father in World War II, one of the things he did with his landing ship, and he was always on the helm for this, was they used to call blow smoke, which was they had smoke canisters and they would build smoke screens for the larger capital ships, the battleships, etc. This is kind of a virtual smoke screen. You could launch these things and they could build a wall to protect whatever it is, ships or whatever. So a really, really funky technology with a lot of potential, good and bad.
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of think about what some of the non-military applications might look like. And, you know, I don't know, chasing away geese from airport property or, you know, some other kinds of predator that's, you know, threatening something. I don't know. It's kind of fun to try to think about what the applications might be. I'm sure there's a lot of them out there that once this capability becomes more available and widespread, that the ideas will just, you know, proliferate. But, you know, the way I actually became aware of this particular swarming drone was from CBS television. And they had an item about this. They had a story about this on the television program 60 Minutes. And because of that, they were allowed to film this swarm. So of 100 Perdix autonomous drones. So they go out there with their cameraman and all their equipment and everything, and they could not get the video, any video that was in any way useful for the program, because of a couple of things. One is the drones, they fly around pretty quickly. Also, the mission of the swarm is maybe known, but how the swarm accomplishes that mission in advance is not known. And they just couldn't capture it. So they thought, how are we going to get some good footage of this swarm, these things zipping around? And they had an idea, you know, who's good at filming things, small things moving fast? And they thought of golf because they're actually videographers who specialize in, you know, zeroing in on that little golf ball as it flies through the air. So they brought in one of those guys, and even he was unable to do it. So they ended up bringing in some, this is a long story, but they ended up bringing in a specialist kind of a camera, and they eventually did get some shots that were useful. But we'll have a link in the show notes to the CBS News story about the capturing of the swarm on video, and it's kind of interesting. It almost made it, David, as our video of the week,
but it didn't. Did it? It's just a news story.
Yeah, we have a video of the week.
This is really kind of cool. Somebody told this guy to take a long walk, so he's taking a long walk. This is from BBC.com, and he's walking the Great Wall of China with a drone.
Mm.
He's taking dronies around the whole Great Wall of China, which is awesome, but kind of bizarre. It seems to me that this video would get a little redundant after a while.
Yeah.
There's really, I mean...
You mean like a wall is a wall?
I'll throw it to you because I believe you've been to the Great Wall of China.
I have. And actually, it's not really a single wall. A lot of people think this is just one long wall, and it's not. It's actually a series of walls and branches off walls that were actually built over the span of hundreds of years. And they range all the way from walls built from rammed earth and wood to stone and brick and everything in between. Also, some of these are, well, you can't even really see them anymore. They've just collapsed and are really in ruins. Others are in moderate shape, and some have been actually restored in ways that makes them look very spectacular, but you kind of wonder how much of it is actually original. But anyway, so you have all of this different these different structures that together are considered to be the Great Wall of China. But this is, I think, a great video. If you haven't seen the Great Wall, if you haven't been there, then this is a nice way to, well, to see not only the wall, but also the kind of countryside where this was built. Really kind of informative and educational, I think. And so, of course, we'll have links to this in the show notes.
Hey, well, maybe somebody will pay me to go back to Scotland, and I'll walk Hadrian's Wall with a drone. We'll do the whole cross England and Scotland with Hadrian's Wall.
They have a wall?
They did. They had a wall that separated the barbarians from the civilized world, which is just in Scotland. It's a lot like the Romans built this wall, and it was really not necessarily a wall so much as gated outposts and sort of a fortress along the border between Scotland and England, the farthest west that the Roman Empire got to. But if it ever gets built, I'll volunteer to fly my walk my drone across the wall between Mexico and the United States.
Uh-oh. All right, so there you have it, walls and drones. We will very carefully avoid any, editorial comments about walls other than what we've said already. And so with that, I think we'll wrap up this episode of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. You can go straight to the show notes for this episode at theuavdigest.com/178.
And, of course, I'm going to do the stuff that my co-host sort of admitted that he forgot how to do, which is, first, we'd like you to join our Slack listener team. And it's getting really active. And it really was fun watching when we had the drone strike, the conversations that everybody had around that going, yeah, maybe, no, maybe. So you can do that by going to our website, theuavdigest.com/team. or you can send us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/theuavdigest. And you can join our 10,000 plus listener Twitter followers on Twitter at UAV Digest. We want you to leave some feedback. And if you want to reach Max or I, our addresses are feedback@theuavdigest.com, David@theuavdigest.com, or Max@theuavdigest.com. And it's 2017, so we're going to implore you, go to iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher.com and leave a review. That it's a new year. We need people to leave us reviews so other people can find us. And that way we can continue to grow the show. And of course, you can get some swag at our Cafe Press store or become a patron of the show at patreon.com. All of those links are on our webpage. And of course, we'd like to thank our sponsors. And with that, I would like to say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
We'll see you next week, and thanks for listening.